The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm Bob McChesney, your host. Media Matters is a new show here on WILL beginning this week, and we hope we'll have a long reign. The idea is to talk about media, media and politics, media and culture, media and society. It's an issue that pervades all our lives, the average American spending 11 or 12 hours a day with media of one form or another. Yet it's an issue we know very little about. We rarely have a chance to examine how it works, for what reasons, the influence it has on us, and how we can change it if we want to. That will be the purpose of our show here on Media Matters at WILL. Every week we'll bring guests to you, nationally known, internationally known, or locally known, to discuss these issues and bring them to the Illinois airwaves and give you an opportunity to call in and talk to them. Our phone number here at Media Matters is 333-9455, and our toll-free number is 800-222-9455. Today is our first show, and for our first show, we're bringing in a very special guest, someone I hope will return to the airwaves many times with us in the coming years. His name is John Nichols. For some of you, the name John Nichols will instantly ring a bell. He's the national political correspondent for The Nation magazine, and really, in my view, one of the truly great political journalists in the United States today, with an extraordinary, even encyclopedic knowledge of American politics and world politics. He's also the editorial page writer for the Capital Times, the daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin, founded by Bob La Follette, and the winner of numerous awards, statewide and national, for his editorials that he's written over the past 15 years. John is joining us today from his home in Madison, Wisconsin. And one last thing about John, he's the author of a popular and very high-selling book called Jews for Buchanan, which just came out last year, published by the New Press, and a book on the 2000 presidential race in Florida. So, John, are you there?
I am with you, Bob, and I'm very honored to be the first guest on. I hope it's going to be a great show.
Well, thanks a lot, John. You know, a lot of people probably aren't too familiar with The Nation magazine, where you are the national political correspondent. Mm-hmm. It's really quite an august institution in American history. Could you give a little bit of a background on it?
Sure. The Nation is the oldest journal of opinion in the United States. Its roots go back to the Civil War era. And it has always been a liberal publication. That definition of that over time has altered in some ways, but it's been around for a very long time, almost 150 years, and has always been in the thick of all the major debates that the U.S. has faced, and really the world. Today, we are based in New York, but have correspondents all over the world and reporters all over the world, and cover mainly politics, international affairs, but also culture. I always remind people that John Leonard, who is perhaps the best respected TV critic in the United States, is a writer for The Nation, and people like Calvin Trillin and others are regular contributors, as well as lots of other folks from all over. This week, for instance, one of our columnists is a guy named George McGovern.
Mm-hmm. And some of the more famous columnists are Christopher Hitchens and Alexander Coburn.
Mm-hmm.
And people who want to check out The Nation and learn more about it is available online at thenation.org. And what sort of stuff do you write for The Nation? What's your beat?
If I can correct you for one second.
Oh, sure.
It's www.thenation.com.
Oh, .com. Excuse me. Thank you.
I apologize.
No, I'm glad you caught that.
And we do welcome people to come. We have daily updates on all sorts of issues there. And your question was, I apologize.
Well, what's your beat there at The Nation?
I cover politics mostly, and that's an awfully broadly defined term. I think that we in the U.S. tend to sometimes be very narrow in our use of the word and to have it just define elections. At The Nation, we tend to define it more, I guess, along the European lines or the Canadian lines, which is that politics is all about the struggle for power, the struggle to define issues, and so my beat extends from looking at elections, which I do a lot, all the way over to looking at protest movements and the struggle within political parties, in our case, particularly within the Democratic Party, to define itself as an opposition to President Bush, although, frankly, I don't think they've done a very good job of it in the last year.
Yeah, there are really three great news stories of the past 18 months, and arguably I think they're the three most important stories of the past 10 or 20 years, or 10 years at least,
mm-hmm.
Which are the 2000 presidential election, the war on terrorism, and now I think they're growing into the broader sort of Middle East crisis we're in the midst of. And then third, the Enron scandal. Mm-hmm. And in each of these, you've written in some length. First and foremost, let's start at the top there. You wrote a book called Jews for Buchanan. What's with the title? What's with the book? What was your book about?
Well, the title is obviously an attempt to boil the whole crisis of the fall of 2000 down into a few words, and that's always hard. But after November 7th of 2000, the United States was thrown into really one of the most significant political crises that the planet has seen in the last, really in the post-war era, and that is that we had an election for President of the United States, and when all was officially said and done in the aftermath of the voting, we didn't know who had won that election. We do know that Al Gore prevailed over George W. Bush by 600,000 votes, which in most Western democracies would be considered a victory. But because of the Electoral College, Gore did not win, and so the fight obviously went down to Florida, where there was this intense 36-day struggle to see who would get that state's electoral votes and thus become president. Jews for Buchanan is about the Florida struggle, all the factors that were in play down there, and really what I believe was a crisis of media, of politics, and of the courts that led to the wrong person becoming president of the United States. I don't mean the wrong person in that I'm suggesting I don't like George W. Bush or I do like him. That's not the point. But simply that the person who most credibly can be said to have won the state of Florida was not George W. Bush. It was Al Gore. And thus, we have to ask ourselves, why was that result not reflected in who became president? The book seeks to explore that.
Yeah, and we're talking to John Nichols, the national political correspondent for The Nation magazine and the author of Jews for Buchanan. I'm Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters. Phone number here is 333-9455 if you have a question for John, or the toll-free number 800-222-9455. John, how is that a political story, the Florida race? I mean, a media story. We know it's a political story, obviously, but how are the media involved as a player in this story?
Well, they were involved from the very beginning, and in so many ways that actually the opening chapter of the book deals with the media. And I guess maybe the best way is to circle back to the title itself. The title, Jews for Buchanan, refers to the thousands of Palm Beach County voters, most of them elderly Jews, some of them Holocaust survivors, many of them retired trade unionists, almost all of them liberals, who, because of a terrible ballot design, ended up casting votes for Pat Buchanan, a man who is broadly seen as an anti-Semite. Whether people agree with that or not, there's certainly that impression is strong. And the media's failure to cover Florida and to cover the playout of the election effectively comes back to simple issues like that. A credible media, a media that knows how to cover politics and knows how to deal with the realities of what happened rather than just the spin of different political camps, would have said, look, something has gone horribly wrong when you have thousands of elderly Jews casting ballots for somebody who they clearly did not want to vote for. And they would have raised the question of whether there should have been a revote in Palm Beach County or perhaps in the whole state of Florida. What we saw instead was a media that, by and large, covered the whole 36-day fight from the perspective of the Gore camp versus the perspective of the Bush camp, bringing no thoughtful analysis, no insight, no challenge to both camps into the process. As a result, voters, the great mass of citizens in this country, were unrepresented in the struggle. One of the reasons that the founders of this country created a free press was because they knew that political factions would seek their own advantage and that the United States needed an independent, overseer, if you will, of the process, and the press was expected to play that role. Its failure to play that role in Florida, I think, really sums up the broad crisis of media today, and it's one of the most dramatic examples of what goes wrong when the media ceases to perform its basic function in a democracy.
Yeah, now, there was a big recount that was done that was released, I believe, in November or December of last year. Is that right, John?
It was in November.
And of all the votes in Florida that were cast, it was done by the major news organizations, as I recall. What did that find, that official, not semi-official, I should say, or quasi-official recount of all the ballots in Florida?
Yeah, in fact, I'd even go one step further and say there's nothing official about it at all.
Yeah, not unofficial.
It was very unofficial because what we found, if you read the, I actually, you know, I'm enough of a political geek to have read all of the documents on it, including all the footnotes. And of course, one of the things the footnotes pointed out was that they weren't actually dealing with the same ballots that were in play in Florida, that many of the counties had lost or destroyed documentation. And so it was nowhere near an official recount.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually pretty, no scientific organization would give it credibility.
Mm-hmm. And they were just dealing with the actual votes that were cast, is that right?
Well, no, it was even worse than that. Some counties did provide all the paperwork, others did not.
Mm.
It was a much more haphazard recount than could credibly be allowed. And that went to the core problem. The recount of Florida should have occurred as part of the electoral process. I mean, you that's how it's supposed to go.
Well, why didn't it?
Who won? Well, the Supreme Court of the United States pulled the plug on it.
Hmm.
In addition, even before that, Florida players such as Catherine Harris had done everything in their power to narrow and restrict the recount to such an extent that you know, as some people, I mean, most people don't know, that more than 110,000 ballots in Florida were never, ever counted. They were never reviewed. In addition, close to 2 million ballots were only reviewed once. There was no recount whatsoever. And so the fact is that there's a broad crisis down there as regards recount. But you ask about the media review.
Well, do we know who, but did this recount that was done, this partial unofficial recount, did it come to any conclusion?
The one the media did?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was very interesting. The headline, of course, was that Bush would have won anyway.
Yeah, that was in our local newspaper here in Champaign-Urbana. Mm-hmm. The headline was Bush Wins in our editorial, in fact, saying that this should end all discussion of the issue from now on.
And that was the official spin from the Bush White House as well. So your paper there in Champaign-Urbana ought to be very proud. It's serving a very traditional governmental role. It's not serving a journalistic role, but that's a choice they've chosen to make. Interestingly enough, the one paper that actually got it right was the Chicago Tribune.
Mm-hmm.
And the Tribune, which is hardly a liberal paper, said that on the basis of the recount, there's a few things we know. And that is that had a recount been done following the rules that Al Gore requested, there's a chance, a good chance, that George W. Bush would have won.
For the whole state or just for those counties?
For the whole state.
Mm-hmm.
And that speaks to the political ineptness of the Gore camp. But also, had the recount, this is the sort of sidelight of it, the thing that was not that much publicized, had the recount been conducted according to the rules requested by the Bush camp, Gore would have won. And more importantly, and this is the thing that was lost like 20 paragraphs down in all the stories, sometimes not published at all, had the recount been conducted according to standard policy, what most Americans would expect would be the approach to a recount, i.e., that you would count every ballot and that you would seek to do your very best to ascertain what the will of the people was,
mm-hmm.
had that been the approach, by just about any measure within it, and they had many different, you know, what type of ballots you count and all that, but virtually every measure in it, Al Gore won, sometimes by as much as 2,000 and 3,000 votes.
All right. Well, what about the media role, then? Let's get back to that.
Well, the media role is just, it was... tragic, tragedy writ large, I guess is the best way to say it, because this was probably, in my view, one of the final nails in the coffin of the claim that the American media plays, as it's currently configured, plays any useful role in a democracy. Some of it is just pure corruption. The Fox News Network, for instance, had George W. Bush's first cousin in charge of analyzing the exit poll results on the night of the election. Now, if this was Zimbabwe or maybe Afghanistan or, you know, some country where we have real doubts about the quality of its democracy, that would be a predictable pattern. You know, you'd expect some cousin of the dictator or some cousin of the ruler would be in charge of defining the results of the election. But in the United States, it's an absurdity. And yet, that was fully accepted. And interestingly enough, it was this cousin of George W. Bush who made the first call on that election night of a Bush victory.
And that was really important, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely important, because most Americans went to sleep late on the night, or early in the morning, actually, of November 8th, 2000, thinking that George W. Bush had been elected president. And from there on out, Al Gore was portrayed as a sore loser. In fact, the only thing that was settled on election night was that George W. Bush's first cousin was able to spin poll results inaccurately to such an extent that not only Fox, but all of the other networks following Fox's lead declared Bush to be a winner. It was a complete collapse of basic journalistic responsibility. In fact, notably, the one entity that did not declare Bush the winner on election night was Associated Press. And Associated Press still follows some basic standards of journalism. And they looked at the polling data, and they said, there's no way you can declare a winner out of this. Yet the networks, which have ceased to cover politics, they only cover spin, were incapable of making that sort of call. And really, that was the story of the entire recount process. They didn't know how to cover a recount. They didn't know how to cover a contested election. They were covering the United States political process as if it was some country they had never been to before, as if they had, you know, the entire U.S. media had been dropped into Bolivia and told, well, you don't know anything about how elections are held here. You don't know anything about the standards of ballot counting or anything like that, but cover it. And they did it that way with the ineptness, the casualness, the sense of irresponsibility, and finally, the impatience of foreigners who were not particularly interested in getting an accurate result. They just wanted to get done in time for their Christmas vacation.
That certainly seemed what I recall so much of the television is with almost this obsession with getting it resolved rather than with getting the truth. We're listening to John Nichols. He's our guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. The phone lines are open, and the number here is 333-9455. The toll-free number is 800-222-9455. John Nichols is the author of Jews for Buchanan, what we're talking about right now. And I should say, for those of you who have not seen the book, it has a cover that has a picture of a guy looking at a ballot. And when I saw the cover, I thought it was a staged photo because this guy has this totally screwed up face. He can't figure out the ballot. It looked like some sort of actor out of Central Casting. And John, as you said, that was an actual photo. Is that right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
It's fact, unbelievable.
Look, the bottom line of the book is, and the bottom line of any discourse about the 2000 election ought to be, that you couldn't make up what occurred. There's no way you could have spun this fantasy out and done a fiction that rivaled the reality of what happened.
John, we've got someone who emailed or called in. They didn't want to go on the air, but they did have one question. And this person is from Mattoon. And they wanted to know about all the controversy concerning black voters in Florida who were prevented from voting on Election Day. Do you discuss that in Jews for Buchanan?
Yeah, quite a bit. And I'm glad to have an email from Mattoon. It means you really are reaching real Illinois there. The black vote is a very serious issue. And a couple things that are worthy of note because, and I emphasize this to folks up front, I didn't just write a book so that we could reflect on something bad that happened. The point of the book is to suggest that reform is needed, new approaches are needed, people need to really examine what's happening to their democracy. And in the black vote, we see that writ large. The state of Florida spent $4 million for the first time in history, purge the state voting rolls of anyone who might have committed a crime, and I emphasize the term might have, because the way that it was done was so casual and so irresponsible that many innocent people were purged. That process fell overwhelmingly on African Americans to such an extent that 31% of African American males of voting age in Florida were denied the right to vote on November 7th, 2000. 31%, one-third. In addition, on November 7th, those who did go to the polls were faced in some places with insurmountable hurdles. What we know is that ballot designs were disproportionately worse in black precincts than in white precincts. Of course, in Florida, they allow various designs from precinct to precinct. On top of that, the technologies in black precincts were dramatically lower quality. White precincts had computers to check whether someone was on the voter roll. Black precincts did not. Finally, we have documented evidence of roadblocks conducted by the state patrol near black precincts. We have evidence of black voters who were wrestled to the ground by police when they objected to their being denied the right to vote. We have an example, my favorite example, the head of the Florida NAACP, the president of the organization, was told when she went to vote that she couldn't vote because she wasn't on the official roll. Now, she's a strong woman, a bold woman, who stood in the polling place and said, "You're going to have to drag me out of here and arrest me if you don't let me vote." And she finally got to someone who got it straightened out, and she was allowed to vote. But the question we have to ask is how many thousands of African-American voters didn't have the courage or the knowledge of their rights or the wherewithal to demand that they be given their right to vote? The crisis of the black vote in Florida is one that really this country as a whole ought to be concerned about, and not just because of Florida. What we know is similar patterns played out in a number of other states. This is not just a Florida crisis. This is a crisis of denial of democracy to those citizens who have, in our lifetimes, had to fight the hardest to have access to the right to vote.
And, John, if I'm not mistaken, that official recount we talked about before that was done, the unofficial, recount by the news media, though, that got all the play, didn't really even talk about this, the people who weren't allowed to vote. It just simply looked at the actual ballots that were cast. Is that right?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things is when you seriously sit down and look at what occurred on that election day and in the weeks prior to it, what you see is that there was a consistent and aggressive effort to diminish the power of the African-American vote at a time when African-Americans in Florida were really coming into their own. There was a very aggressive voter registration campaign followed by strong get-out-the-vote campaigns. I mean, it's sort of everything that you would want in a democracy was occurring, and yet profound barriers were being placed in the way of this process.
You're listening to John Nichols, my guest today in Media Matters. I'm Bob McChesney. We have a caller from Terre Haute. Before we go to the caller, let me say if you'd like to join us and talk to John, the number is 333-9455, 800-222-9455 is the toll-free number. In addition to the Florida race, we're soon to be talking about the war on terrorism and the Enron scandal, both of which John has covered in detail. But now let's go to Terre Haute. You're on the air with John Nichols.
Hi, good afternoon, and thank you for taking my question.
Good afternoon.
I'll listen to the answer off the air. I'm glad you mentioned a segment coming up on terrorism. I would like to know if your research has uncovered any links between the confusion around our electoral process and the events of last September. Thank you.
Okay, John.
Yeah, I appreciate the call. I think that it's we would be stretching a bit to suggest that there are direct links between the confusion over the electoral processes and the September 11 terrorist attacks. I don't see a connection there. In fact, I would go to a point to suggest that whether Al Gore or George W. Bush was president, there are reasons to believe that many of those developments would have followed the same pattern. I will say that the caller points to a very serious reality, which is that the confusion in last November and December did raise real questions about the legitimacy of the Bush government with governments around the world. There is no question that in Europe, and especially in Southern Asia and India, to a lesser extent Pakistan and Australia and New Zealand, you find a lot of discussion about whether George W. Bush is really a legitimate leader of the United States. And that is rooted in the fact that especially a lot of the European press, frankly, covered the conflict over the 2000 election better than the American press did. As a result, a lot of Europeans, particularly French, Brits, have an understanding of the collapse of democratic processes that occurred. And another play out of it that was fascinating just recently was in Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe had a very contested election, and Robert Mugabe retained power there in a process that many people thought was not run well, that had extreme problems, and the United States was critical of that electoral process. Immediately, though, Mugabe and his supporters came back and said, "How dare you criticize us for how we hold an election when you had these absolute disaster of November and December 2000. And so it has certainly harmed the ability of the U.S. to talk to the rest of the world effectively about democracy. There's no doubt of that.
It's funny you should mention that. Not funny, but interesting, because in The Nation, the magazine you write for, Eric Alterman had a column about a month ago after President Bush's Axis of Evil speech, and he noted that the Iran, one of the countries that has been identified as part of the Axis of Evil, actually has an elected president. So it puts us in an awkward position.
Well, the fact is that many countries around the world struggle, really an uphill struggle at times, to establish a legitimate democracy. It's not easy. Places with a long tradition of dictatorship, of colonialism, of foreign intervention, have a hard time making democracy work. That's no mystery. And so the fact that the United States, with supposedly a more than 200-year tradition of democracy, which for a very long time has preached to the rest of the world about how to do it, can't pull it off, is something that a lot of the rest of the world has noted and objected to. It, again, we as Americans, no matter what your politics, should have been deeply concerned at the time, not about who won the election, not about whether it was Bush or Gore, but about the fact that this American democracy functioned appropriately.
Mm-hmm.
That failure to make sure it functioned appropriately definitely harms the U.S.
We've got another caller on the air, this one from a local call from Champaign County. If you'd like to join us and talk to John Nichols here on Media Matters, the number is 333-9455, or the toll-free number is 800-222-9455. Hello, you're on the air with John Nichols.
Hi. Great fan, great show. I'm glad you guys are here. It's great to hear it. I've got two things, and you're moving towards Enron, I think, but I wanted to ask specifically about the point that isn't being covered much, and that's this whole international reach. There's a new study from the Institute for Policy Studies that just lays it out amazing. 28 countries and $7 billion of the country's own funds were used to... Anyway, I don't know if Mr. Nichols has worked that part in very much. We have Anandate Roy, who did a lot on Enron in India, and it's still not being talked about much. And I think the other point was just the election and how African Americans were deprived of the vote in Florida. And the idea, and maybe it'd be a great time for you to state this thesis that I've heard you put so well, Professor McChesney, that... because journalists see themselves as professional, they can't bring up something that the two parties aren't talking about. And that was a great... both of those issues are, I think... both of those topics sort of highlight how that is used to constrain the limits of allowable debate. And again, kudos and thanks to WL for having the chutzpah to have you on and say these dissident things.
Well, thank you very much for the call. John, let's talk about Enron. Let's move to Enron if we can. And actually, the caller might not know this, but you've written quite a bit on Enron for The Nation, including in the most recent issue, a piece specifically on what Dick Cheney knew and his relationships with Enron. Dick Cheney, of course, the vice president. So what's your take on Enron, the significance of it, the nature of the coverage, and the extent of the scandal? What is the scandal all about?
Well, there's a lot of questions there, and we could do a whole show on them. But let me first mention to the caller that the IPS study, Institute for Policy Study, is very, very good. There's also, for folks who want to go online, there's a place called the Polaris Institute in Canada. You can just search on your search engine and find it. That's done fantastic work on this. And I did a cover story of The Nation on March 4th titled Enron's Global Crusade that really tries at least to examine a lot of where Enron was around the world, what it did, and how it did so almost entirely because of its close relations with the U.S. government. And so I lay that out to suggest that there are huge stories about Enron, what it did, how it worked, particularly how it succeeded in getting away with acts that were simply criminal because of their close political ties to the Bush administration and to people in government. The media coverage of it has been beyond atrocious. It has been, for the most part, indefensible. There is a tendency on the part of most American media to cover this as a business story. I will say up front and with passion, there is no business story related to Enron. This has nothing to do with business. This is entirely a story about politics. This is entirely a story about Ken Lay, a former Defense Department analyst who, because of his role in the government, figured out a way to scam a lot of money. And then he went out and used political and personal ties to people in government to create a lie, the fiction of a corporation, which made money almost entirely because of doors that were open to it in government, doors that were open to it because of its campaign contributions, and doors that were open to it because it moved around the world with literally billions of dollars of loan guarantees backed up by U.S. taxpayers because of the cozy relations between Ken Lay, his corporation, and the U.S. Export-Import Bank and the Overseas Private Investment Corporation, two federal agencies which do the absolute worst form of corporate welfare on the planet.
Well, John, why? What's Dick Cheney's role specifically in the Enron scandal? Because that's the subject of your most recent cover story.
Well, Dick Cheney, I mean, the best way to understand what Dick Cheney did is to connect it to the election and to say that after these folks got away with essentially stealing the presidency of the United States, they came into office on January 20th, 2001, absolutely assured in their own minds that they could do anything they want. Within 9 days, Dick Cheney, who is by any measure the corporate consigliere of the administration, the guy whose job it is to make sure that campaign contributors are taken care of, set up a energy task force that over the next 6 to 7 months met with, attracted, reached out to all of the large energy corporations in the U.S., but above all to Enron. And what Cheney did in that role is some of the most corrupt and indefensible activity we've seen in the White House really since the days of Warren Harding. Cheney met in April of last year with Ken Lay of Enron. During that meeting, Lay walked in with a memo saying that Enron wanted the administration to take a strong stand against price caps in California because of the California energy crisis. Even Republicans out there were arguing that price caps were needed to keep corporations from profiteering off the crisis. The next morning, Dick Cheney called the Los Angeles Times and gave a very rare exclusive interview to the Los Angeles Times saying the Bush administration was against price caps and essentially echoing the exact language of Ken Lay's memo. And that's just the beginning of dozens of actions taken by Dick Cheney at the clear behest of Enron, leading up to and including the final report of the Energy Task Force, which included 7 of the 8 major recommendations made by Enron in a memo given to Cheney as official policy of the Bush administration. It goes beyond even the imagination, the extent to which Dick Cheney carried out Enron's lobbying mission. It's amazing that Enron even bothered to hire lobbyists. They had their best lobbyists sitting in the White House.
Now, how does something like this, though, compare with like the Whitewater scandal, which got so much attention during the Clinton administration?
Well, the Clintons were jokers. I mean, these were really kind of low-level players from rural Arkansas. And the Whitewater scandal, if you'll recall, was really a fight about a couple of lots. You know, you're talking about, like, you know, are you going to buy this land for $50,000 or $75,000? It was such low-grade, minor stuff that it's almost comic that we worried about it. Whereas what Dick Cheney was doing was literally altering the energy policy of the United States of America, both domestically and internationally, to serve the interests of a corporate contributor. And the extent of the corruption, Patriots ought to be concerned about this, you know, these classic American patriots, because, among other things, after the September 11th attacks, when Dick Cheney was talking to government officials in India, a country that was very much in play as regards the war on terrorism, he would, at the start of conversations with these people, bring up the lobbying interests of Enron. He would put that ahead of, you know, core questions of domestic and international security for the United States. It is something that it makes the entire Clinton scandals, you know, all of them combined, look like, you know, a minor footnote. It wouldn't even make a chapter in a book on presidential scandals. Whereas what Cheney's done would be right up there with Watergate and with Warren Harding's whole Teapot Dome scandal as a real complete corruption of the office.
You're listening to John Nichols today on Media Matters. He's discussing press coverage of the Enron scandal, the war on terrorism, and the 2000 presidential election. John is the Washington correspondent for The Nation magazine. We have a couple of lines open. If you'd like to call in, the number 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. John, we've got a caller from Urbana. Let's go to the phone lines again. Hello, you're on the air with John Nichols.
Hi there.
Hi. Glad to have you call.
Thanks. Given the corporate, the corporate-owned media, you know, the effect of all the consolidation with mainstream media recently, do you think there's any possibility that with their short attention spans, things like the Enron scandal and the presidential election of 2000 will be reported more widely? Thanks.
It's a terrific question, and it does get to some of the real concerns I have about where media is at in the U.S. today. There is simply no question that the lack of understanding of, commitment to, and really interest in serious reporting on the part of most of the people who run U.S. media is actually defining the results of political debates and processes. Certainly, Enron is a story that ought to be the kind of the meat of media during this period. It ought to be something that reporters are digging into aggressively in the same way they did to Watergate. But at most major media in this country, it's fallen off the front pages. In many cases, it's been relegated to the business pages where it's treated as, you know, kind of a another one of those complex stories about how some company didn't do a very good annual report and maybe we're going to have to change some filing rules and some regulations.
You know, John, if I can interrupt here. You know, one of the reasons that Whitewater became a big story was that there were a lot of Republicans in the Senate and the House, like Bob Barr, to mention just one of them, who, you know, constantly raising hell, saying this is a crucial issue. We've got to investigate this, and they got a special prosecutor. Why aren't the Democrats doing the same thing with the Republicans?
Why, indeed. This gets to a broader question that goes beyond media all the way to our campaign finance system. The fact is that the overwhelming majority of members of the House and the U.S. Senate received direct campaign contributions from Enron's Political Action Committee and or from executives of Enron. And this includes top Democrats, people like Joe Lieberman, who is supposedly in charge of the committee that would be doing the core investigations of this. The result is the Democrats have been staggeringly unwilling to fight on these issues. And I've got to be honest with you. I give credit to – are we still on?
Yeah, we're still on. It was our caller, I guess, didn't want to stay on the air.
Appreciate it. I give credit to Bob Barr and Henry Hyde and all these people I disagree with passionately because they really wanted to go after Bill Clinton. I may not have agreed with why they went after him or how they did it, but at least they aggressively, you know, stood on principle. The fact of the matter is virtually no Democrats in Congress have been willing to stand on principle against the Bush administration's extreme levels of illegality and wrong dealing in regard to the Enron scandal. I will make a couple of quick exceptions, though, and one of them is Henry Waxman, the congressman from the Los Angeles area, who really has aggressively gone after these issues. If you go to Henry Waxman's website, you will see some fantastic detailing of information that he has forced the release of from the administration. In addition, there are a couple other members of Congress, Bob Filner of California, who has moved a proposal for a special prosecutor in this matter, and I think that's absolutely essential. And a handful of others have raised tough questions. Fritz Hollings in the U.S. Senate's done a pretty good job. But there's nowhere near the consistent drive to open this issue up. And that gets back to the crisis of media. Our media in this country, by and large, is incapable of figuring out what a story is on its own. Most news editors and assignment editors today wait to be told what a political story is by the politicians. And if the Democrats in Congress do not aggressively pursue this issue, the media will, by and large, let it go away.
You know, we've got another caller here, and we've got a couple lines open. If you want to talk to John Nichols, the number 333-9455, or the toll-free number 800-222-9455. Here's a caller from Urbana. Hello, you're on the air with John Nichols.
Good to hear you on the air. Talking about illegality, isn't it, I recall Gregory Palast saying that in reference to the 2000 vote, Catherine Harris was told not to, as I recall, it was she was told not to, or forced actually not to hire another felon voter purge company like she did in 2000. For this coming election, but she's defied the order or whatever, and she's rehired of a similar company, and therefore she's setting up Jeb Bush's reelection all over again. I was wondering, do you know about that? And secondly, what about not only you were talking about putting charges against people in reference to Enron, but isn't there a whole lot of things that could be charged in reference to the 2000 election as well?
Two good questions. Let's first go to Greg Palast's reporting, which is terrific stuff.
I should add also, for the sake of our listeners, that 1 week from today, Greg Palast will be our guest on the show.
Terrific. And Greg, notably reporting for a British publication, did some terrific work on opening up the details of some of the scandals in Florida. I devote a substantial portion of the book to looking at some of the work Greg did and then extending beyond it to a lot of the examination of how Florida officials sought to disenfranchise African Americans. And the thing to note is that, yes, Catherine Harris has consistently engaged in acts that were clearly political rather than under the rubric of her job as Florida Secretary of State, and the politics was aimed at electing George Bush president, at reelecting Jeb Bush to the governorship of Florida. And the most serious matter is not so much who she hired to do these purges of the voter rolls. That is significant. But much more important is what she told the people who were hired to do. And what we detail in the book with emails back and forth, which were gotten through Freedom of Information Act requests, is the fact that the people who were doing the purchase, the corporations that were doing it, emailed Catherine Harris's office and said, look, we can't do it the way you're telling us to, because if we do, we will unquestionably disqualify legitimate eligible voters. We will deny the franchise to people who should not be denied the franchise. And Catherine Harris's office emailed back, that's fine, we'll take care of it. And so what we know is that this is an office that had the statutory responsibility to protect the right to vote, that had a responsibility to make sure that elections functioned, and intentionally went against, violated, undermined that goal. So Catherine Harris is a terribly bad player, and I'll give one other key example. Like so many things in a capitalist society, this is about money. Catherine Harris and Jeb Bush authorized spending $4 million to purge the voting rolls in Florida. And yet, in the weeks before the 2000 election, they were asked if they could spend $100,000, a mere $100,000, to make sure that people understood how to vote, how the ballots worked, generally to try and deal with some of the confusion regarding the Florida ballots. Catherine Harris refused to authorize the spending of that $100,000. She actually opposed it. So did Jeb Bush. So they could find $4 million to knock people off the voting roll, but they couldn't find 100,000 to tell people how to vote. It's a horrific approach to democracy, and one that we should all be very angry about, especially as Catherine Harris prepares to run for Congress.
Now, John, what's, you know, in the last year, one of the biggest selling books in the media, in fact, I'd say probably the biggest selling book in the media, has been a book called Bias by a former CBS producer, which says that the news media in this country have a spectacular liberal bias against conservatives, against Republicans. If that's the case, why aren't things like the 2000 presidential election or Enron getting much more, the Republicans being dragged over the coals in these issues?
Well, I mean, let's be clear. Bernard Goldberg is wrong. I mean, he's fundamentally wrong in his approach to the issues. And for a couple of reasons. One, typically, he focuses almost entirely on a handful of social issues. And he says the media is biased because the media is not rough on gays and lesbians, because the media, by and large, treats abortion as a settled issue that the courts have established that it's legal, that most Americans in polls suggest they want safe and legal abortion. And so as a result, he says there's a bias because the media doesn't challenge those accepted realities. I mean, it is a construct that in and of itself is absurd. It would be like saying that the media is biased because it accepts basically that, you know, we ought to have a democracy in America, that we ought to have elections. Just because something's established and you go along with it doesn't mean you're biased. That's number one problem that Goldberg gets into. Number two problem that Goldberg falls into, or the real mistake of his book, is the suggestion that we have a liberal media in the U.S. It's comic. The fact is that most newspapers in the U.S. that do endorsements endorsed George W. Bush for president. I mean, George W. Bush was the preferred candidate of the media. The overwhelming push of most print, and to a lesser extent, because television media is not analyzed through its endorsements and its actual statements, but more through, you know, evidence of bias on it, is toward a conservative, pro-corporate stance on virtually every issue, and also toward a quote-unquote stability. The reason that the 2000 election is not brought up on a regular basis is because George W. Bush is a preferred leader of most media. He is also someone who is good for business. And the intention of most media is to not be a particular boat rocker or, you know, rabble rouser, but rather to make sure that things are good for business in America. This is best exampled by the NAFTA and GATT fights of the 1990s, in which when you analyze where media statements on how Congress should vote on those issues went, remember, Congress split almost evenly on the issue of NAFTA, and yet media editorials were about 98% in favor of NAFTA.
In fact, weren't you personally the author of the 2% that went against it?
I did work for two different newspapers in 93, and both of those newspapers did oppose NAFTA. So, yeah, it's astounding. Literally, in this country, particularly on economic issues, the bias of the media toward a very conservative, pro-corporate stance is so overwhelming, I mean, so stunning, that it's not even open to debate. And Goldberg's book, it's comic, because here you look at fundamental issues of how people's lives are lived, whether they have jobs, whether their environment can be protected, whether they have some sort of democratic control over their lives. On every one of those issues, the media has taken very conservative stances that parallel those of Wall Street and the Bush administration. There is a bias, there's no question.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that the bias goes in the exact opposite direction from what Bernard Goldberg suggests.
We're talking with John Nichols, the national correspondent, Washington correspondent for The Nation magazine, and our guest today on Media Matters. We've only got a few minutes left, but there is time for a phone call. Someone wants to call in at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 for the toll-free number. John, earlier you talked about the problem with Enron could be looked at in terms of campaign finance, that the Democrats, most of them, especially the leading Democrats in Congress, had received ample donations from Enron, just like the Republicans, which made them somewhat reluctant to aggressively pursue the corruption in this case. One result of the Enron scandal has been the passage and signing into law of a campaign finance reform bill. What's your assessment? Is this going to change things radically for the better? What's your take on campaign finance and how that's going to affect elections in the coming years?
My take on campaign finance is what it has always been. We don't need to reform how elections are financed in the United States. We need to assert ethics in Congress and in our legislatures around the country. The fact of the matter is no one should be allowed to vote on a bill that would affect the interests of a corporation, a PAC, or a big giver who has contributed to their campaign.
Gee, that takes all the fun out of being in politics.
It sure would. It would require them to actually serve the public interest as opposed to serving the interests of their campaign contributors. The fact of the matter is that the McCain-Feingold bill has some good components to it, and I'm glad it passed. But the reality is that it makes no demands on legislators, members of Congress, to be honest players.
You know, John, I'm going to go to the phone lines now because we've got two callers and only a couple minutes left. So let's just go right to the lines here. Hello, Bloomington, Illinois. You're on the air with John Nichols.
I was just wondering how the guests would rate, like, public TV and public radio in general.
Sure.
And as far as the presidential election goes, how they did there.
I think they did minimally better than the commercial broadcasters. I think they tried to try and be a little bit more responsible, but I will emphasize that it was a public TV correspondent or primary player, Jim Lehrer, who was the host of the horrible, indefensibly bad Gore-Bush debates of 2000. And that, for that alone, public TV takes a little bit of a poke. But I will give NPR credit for being a little bit better than the commercial broadcasters.
Okay. And now let's hear a caller from Urbana on the air with John Nichols. Go ahead.
Oh, greetings. I'm very glad that your program is on the air. I've been listening with interest, and I'm wondering if you have any suggestions now that we are, you know, informed about how horrible things have been. What can the normally irate people like myself over both the Enron and the election that happened?
What a great call.
Really, what a good one to end on, too.
Yeah, how much time do we have, Bob?
We've been independent media center, and we have WEF, but now how can we make a change in how reporters report and how the truth can maybe get out a little farther?
You've got about a minute, John.
That's terrific. What I will tell you is this. Number one, keep listening to this show every Sunday. It'll be a good start in the process. Number two, you can go to the web is a rich resource. There are many sites there that are useful. One of them is www.thenation.com. You can find a lot of information about the issues we're talking about. In addition, there are a lot of good publications out there in these times, The Nation, Mother Jones, others that you should be reading. Finally, and I think this is the most important thing, you need to get involved at the grassroots level in your community, not just with political activity in the traditional sense, but also with the broader push for media reform. There's a lot of movement on that in that zone, and this is the place where we all need to get active. We shouldn't just reform our elections. We should reform the sources of information that help people to make decisions. And I'm actually very optimistic. I go all over the country, and I hear a lot of people who are energized and angry and excited to make real reforms in this country.
John,
I don't think we're going to get beat on this one. I think we win eventually.
Yeah, John, great. We're going to have you on to talk about that again. Thanks so much for being our first guest on Media Matters. We're going to have you back a lot. Next week, our guest will be Greg Palast, the American journalist based in Britain who's broken so many important stories. And thank you all for listening to the first edition of Media Matters. I'd like to thank especially Jack Brighton and the people at WILL and my producer, Ben Scott. So thank you all, and talk to you next week.